Good afternoon. Today is Monday, the 25th of March, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish, and I'm delighted to have with me today Alex Thompson from the Netherlands and Mark Anderson from the United States. Plus, we have a guest. So, Alex, we're going to kick straight off with the sad reality of Ukraine. It seems to get ever more awful. The reports coming in, of course, from the battlefield are simply horrific as Russia is attempting to take more territory in the special military operation, and the Ukrainians, supposedly short of ammunition, are just throwing men at the front. But of course, we've also had the attack in Moscow. So altogether, it's pretty horrific what's going on. What have you got for us?
Brian, we have been reporting for some weeks that Britain has already been telling its people that a war may be on the horizon, direct involvement. Certain European continental countries, particularly in Northern Europe, have been following suit. But this has spread to France, despite President Macron's previous aim, really, as long as he's been president, despite his being fully paid up to NATO, his aim until now of trying to play some kind of honest broker and standing up for Russia's geopolitical ambitions. However, insincerely, Macron flipped the script last week and he said that French troops may be committed on the ground. He said it couldn't be ruled out anymore. So you can see here on LCI, which is a French equivalent of CNN, a talking heads channel for the right thinkers, that newscasters, propagandists are already looking at big maps of Ukraine with the red belt in the south and east of Russian occupied territory, and envisaging what the scenarios would be for French troops on the ground. The right-hand image there suggests that French troops visiting the country via Poland could be sent to the center of the country to defend the River Dnipro line if the Russians intend to get that far. The left-hand image suggests that Belarus, Russia's ally, would be held back. It's getting rather damaging for French reputation, and we see that particularly in the last 48 hours with an interview conducted by BFM TV. Many people actually think that this is one of the less bad French legacy channels. It's certainly very popular in France for its direct style and less highfalutin than you usually get in French talk TV. Here they're interviewing Pyotr Tolstoy. Yes, he is the great-grandfather of the famous novelist. He's also a long-term France watcher and has worked for Russian media in France. And here he has come straight out and says, "We don't care a whit for what, I'm just going to say Napoleon, what a Freudian slip, for what Macron has to say. If you send troops in, we will kill every last one of them." And as is the way with President Putin and others in the Russian government, he then lists off how many mercenaries there are in the country, how many were French, and how many of those, roughly half, about 147, I think he says, have already been dispatched, have been killed. So he's quite in your face about it. "We do not care, and we're going to kill every last one that enters the country." Over in Germany, the vice chancellor, the equivalent of a deputy prime minister at federal level, Mr. Habeck, was giving a speech the other day to a conference called Europe 2024. And as reported for by T Online here, he was saying Germany needs to be prepared for a land war, the same language as Macron. But here he's talking more economically, as you would imagine the Germans do, and saying, quite incredibly, that Germany can afford it. He was asked particularly in the question and answer of this session, if we have to spend a lot more on guns, does that mean less butter? And he said, not necessarily. "Look at Wall Street," he said. "They capitalize themselves a lot better than Europe. And we are a great go-ahead economy, so we can manage. It's a repeat of 2015, Angela Merkel's Wir schaffen das. We can manage to absorb it with countless people." So here he's saying the total amount of state indebtedness doesn't really matter. He says for raising capital, because he thinks it's about a German general drive as a kind of limited liability company to raise capital, he says it doesn't really matter whether we are 63 or 64% of our GDP in debt. We can manage it. And once we've produced these goods, he says, there'll be spin-off benefits for the rest of the economy, the goods being tanks and rockets and so on, and they will sit there until they're needed. Up in Denmark, This completes a Scandinavian triad now of countries, Norway, Sweden and Denmark, that conscript girls at the age of 18. Here in the Netherlands and in a couple of other countries in Europe, there is a nominal conscriptability of men and women at 18 in the interest of gender equality, but there is no active draft. But you'll find the details on Politico there that the Danes are getting quite serious about it. People might think an enlightened move, but if you consider which other countries actively conscript girls at 18 rather than just send them a letter saying that they could be drafted, other than those Scandinavian three, it's Israel and then North Korea, Burma, Chad, Eritrea. It doesn't really seem like a good club to be in, a bit like how Sweden, Germany and North Korea and now France are the only countries in the world that absolutely mandate school attendance rather than homeschooling, home education for children. Over in the States, Lindsey Graham, one of the most hawkish of all US senators, if not the most hawkish, was in Kyiv in the middle of this month, urging Ukraine to tighten up its own draft laws. And he had the gall to say that it's wrong that Ukraine has exempted its student age men from the draft. There's no question at the moment openly of drafting women. But he says that men under 27 must be conscriptable in Ukraine. So he's coming to the country and telling them that. He says, I can't believe that the threshold is 27. You should be serving, i.e. as soon as you're 18. We, who's that, Senator Graham, we need more people in the line. That's the meat grinder line you were just talking about, Brian. Looks to me like he wants young blood.
Yes, it's horrific what these people are doing. And of course, the one thing we don't see in Western pieces, in Western press, is the call for peace. Let's just have a look at the cruel reporting on the Moscow mall and conference hall attack. So this is the Telegraph. Britain warns Putin not to use Moscow attack to intensify war on Ukraine, as if it was needed, because, of course, that conflict has already intensified as the West, the US, UK, EU, NATO pump in the little weapons they've got remaining. And the Ukrainians are being encouraged to send their young and elderly men to the slaughter on the front. These are some of the comments from the article, which we'll just put up. Apparently, Putin's desperation to put all of this on Ukraine is unsurprising as he tries to further dupe the Russian people while pretending that there is no dissent within Russia. So we can't even say who the person is making this report to the Telegraph. But of course, it goes on, picked up by the Mail today, where apparently the attack in Moscow is simply the fault of Putin because he's so incompetent as a leader, he allowed it to happen. This is the madness of Western press. Here is one of Britain's politicians commenting. Russian media channels are already circulating deep fake videos of Ukrainian officials in an attempt to blame Ukraine and provide Putin some defense for the war crimes he's committing in Ukraine, or worse, pretext for further atrocities. So we've just simply abandoned the truth and facts. This is just claims being made against Putin and what's happening. Alicia Cairns goes on to say there's no indication of any link to Ukraine, nor any credible reason to suggest their involvement. Well, I could think of lots of reasons to suggest they could be involved, but yes, we do need to see the absolute facts of what's happened. And of course, the Americans going the other way, so they're saying that they strongly condemn the heinous terrorist attacks in Moscow. We extend our deepest condolences to those who lost loved ones and to those who were injured or affected by these unconscionable attacks against innocent civilians. ISIS is a common terrorist enemy that must be defeated everywhere. There is no indication of any link to Ukraine, nor any credible reason to suggest their involvement. Well, of course, the Americans haven't come up with any evidence themselves, but they are desperate to make sure that it's ISIS-K, the Afghanistan version, which is blamed for this attack. And the Americans keen to steer anything away from Ukraine, even though it does appear that those terrorists were trying to reach the safe haven of Ukraine when they were caught by Russian authorities. And I'm just going to play this little bit of video on screen. This is a little girl in Gaza. You can see the distress on this young lady's face. words. There are no words for what's going on at the moment in the world. But as I said a few moments ago, the key thing is that in the West, in UK, we appear to have very, very few politicians prepared to stand up and actually call for peace and to put an end to this massive and escalating bloodshed. So when viewers ask us what should they be doing, we will say once again, you should be on the back of your MPs asking why they are pushing for war and why they're not pushing for peace. We'll break on to the new subject of child abuse in Scotland. And we have a guest today, Professor, Professor Diane Rasmussen-McCaddy, who's going to give us an update on what's been happening around the Ffynethi women. Just to put this image up on screen, and this shows some of the women outside Glasgow Council with the banner "Release Our Records and End Our Ffynethi Nightmare Now." We've got a second image here, which has actually got Professor Rasmussen-McCaddy herself with the Ffynethi women. And Diane, I'd like to welcome you onto UK Column today, where you're going to give us a little update as to what's been happening. Welcome.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be here. Thanks very much for this. Those two photos were taken just last week at the meeting of the Petitions Committee. I will add that the first photo that you showed from outside, because although we requested mainstream media sources to come and cover the story and read a press release and make a statement about 20 minutes before they were supposed to be there, they phoned and had last minute staff absences and suddenly could not be coming to cover this important event. So I did what I could. So thanks for showing that.
Okay. Diane, sorry, just to come back in. I was going to say we have several little film clips here. The first one is actually the Deputy First Minister from Scotland talking at the committee meeting. I was going to say, let's just watch this first clip to hear what she has to say, and then we'll bring you back in for a critique.
The executive summary headline findings, just to summarise, why the girls were sent to Ffynethi. The findings were that primary school girls from Glasgow were sent to convalescence after an illness and or so that they might benefit from what was termed a recuperative holiday. The school was one of a number of schemes of residential education which was aimed at improving the health of pupils. In terms of who sent them, it was head teachers and school medical staff could put forward girls that they thought might benefit from a stay. However, it was the school or principal medical officer who took the final decision. And even then, only girls whose parent or guardian agreed to them going and who passed two medical examinations were allowed to go.
Well, there we are. That was the key lady, Robison, speaking. How do you feel about what she said, Diane?
Well, just in those few seconds, there were a number of inaccuracies. First of all, there was one scheme of residential education, which was set up by what was then Glasgow Corporation back in 1945, which was set up post-war as an experiment within the city of Glasgow to see what would happen when different children were sent away for whatever amount of time. And there were a number of classifications that they assigned to these children. One happened to be convalescent, which if you actually look at what happened over time, the excuse was that they were sent for a recuperative holiday, as she said, but actually, if you actually speak to the women, most of them were not unwell. They were sent there. In other paperwork, it said it was because they were from deprived backgrounds, poor socioeconomic status, children with parents of alcoholics, etc. Some said they came from perfectly fine backgrounds. So it's still a bit of a mystery as to why they were actually sent there. And the coercion is a really important thing because we see, as you'll see in some of the debates about in loco parentis, which essentially meant that the parents really did not have a choice as to whether they were sent because they were, there was legislation at the time that said in Scotland that children could be taken away from the custody of their parents and put into the custody of the state if the state decided that for whatever reason, the parents weren't fit to keep their children in the house. So there are a number of inaccuracies here just in these first couple of seconds, which is from the opening statement. And I think we have some more that we can show as well.
Yes, indeed. And we can say that if the girls weren't ill before they went to Fonethi, many, many of them were ill afterwards as a result of the treatment. But let's hear a little bit more about the records.
It should be noted, though, that Fonethi is not unique in having no surviving logbooks. In terms of the records, information on Fonethi that Glasgow City Council holds, basically what Dr. Fossey found is that Glasgow City Council holds no school records for Fonethi. The City Archives holds various series of Council Education Committee minutes, papers, reports and handbooks that talk of Fonethi and other schools in the schemes, but no individual records. In terms of what action Glasgow City Council has taken to find existing records, they have run their own internal searches in response to FOI and subject access requests. And of course, Dr. Fossey and Diane McCarty had access to records in the archives. And Glasgow's chief archivist themselves has also carried out proactive searches for information on Fonethi. So I hope, convener, that gives you a sense of what the remit was and what the kind of key findings that have been found are.
So, Diane, I'm sure you've got something to say on that. Of course, she dropped your professional title as one comment, which we should note.
Yes, that is something that Shona Robinson did herself, but the other MSPs who spoke with her did not. My title is actually professor, which only 10% of academics in the UK are assigned that title eventually. Dr. Fossey got her title throughout, and it was something that the women picked up on especially. In terms of the other items that she mentioned, regarding records, first of all, there are statutes within Glasgow and I would assume without all of Scotland that said that there were limitations on when records could be released because of data protection issues. For example, pupil records were destroyed within 5 years at the latest from when children left school, which means that there are no records for anyone in Scotland if we were going by that particular legislation, regardless of the nature of the school that they were in. Logbooks are closed for 50 years. Admissions registers are closed for 75 years. And so it's pretty clear to me that these are just excuses because this is the legislation. The records wouldn't be in the archives, the records that she spoke of in terms of personal records or pupil records or teacher records, because archives in Glasgow City Council, I know because I spent a lot of time there, have things like committee minutes, committee reports, education committee handbooks, which I've gone through in great detail. But it wouldn't make any sense anyway to find personal records. And so regardless of the researcher that she put into place, those records wouldn't be found. So that is quite an unacceptable excuse on Shona Robson's part.
Okay, thank you for that. Well, we can reinforce your comment there. If we have a look at this clip, there were members of the Scottish Parliament that spoke up for the Fonethi women. Let's have a listen to what Oliver Mundell had to say in response to the Deputy First Minister.
Oliver Dyer, you've got a supplementary to my question?
Yeah, no, I'm just quite, to be honest, appalled by that answer, because I think I understand why the report was commissioned, but I don't think it's consistent with what the previous Deputy First Minister and then Education Secretary said as the bill went through Parliament. I was on and off that committee through that time, but he acknowledged that there wouldn't be, he said it was unlikely that documentary evidence would be available in every circumstance. He didn't talk about certainty. He talked about on the balance of probabilities. He offered repeat reassurances that people would be believed, that the principle would be that where survivors came forward and they offered testimony, that would be taken as fact, not that it would be questioned. And the second thing I find pretty hard to swallow, given it was discussed through the passage of the bill, is this relationship that's been presented between parents and the local authority. It's not true. It is not true. It is not factually correct. And it's still not correct to this day. Local authorities, through social work, through education, wield a huge amount of authority over families where they suggest things and direct things vulnerable families feel under pressure to accept them. It is not a relationship of equals, and I think it is wrong to categorise the relationship in that way.
Well, some pretty direct criticism there, because he's effectively saying it's not true what's been put forward by the First Minister. Well, that's how I take it. And of course, the other thing is he said at the end of the day, what's important is that people are believed. So, Diane, good to see that he was really prepared to stand up and be counted in his support for the Fonethi women.
Absolutely. There are several MSPs that have been in their corner, starting with Colin Smith, MSP from South of Scotland, who has kind of led the campaign through the Scottish Parliament all the way. Another one that you'll see is Fergus Ewing, who is kind of become he's SNP, but he's kind of left the sort of ranks of the SNP in recent years. He also spoke out widely in favor of the women. And so this is coming from Labour, from SNP, and from Conservatives. So I can see that even though, you know, there's a potential election coming up, of course, this year and next year in Scottish Parliament, I think that I'm very, very proud to say that we do have some very strong political support on the side of the Fonethi ladies. And I would hope that we can all reach out and thank them and continue to do the wonderful work they're doing for them.
Okay, thank you for that. And the last clip, which really pushes the whole thing home, is Oliver Mundell again, but he's talking about really the application process versus the evidence, which is the women themselves and the numbers, 200 at the moment in the group, but possibly thousands of women abused over the timescale that Fonethi was operating. Let's listen to this last section.
But in order for an application to be brought in front of Redress Scotland, evidence is required. So there has to be records showing
There doesn't have to be records. I know that from my own constituents. What you have to prove is on the balance of probabilities something was more likely to have happened than not. And you know, I'm aware of payments being made to people who haven't been able to find records but have been able to put other circumstantial evidence together to support an application. And in this case, you know, we've got a great many people from various parts of Scotland, particularly in the Glasgow area, who are able to corroborate and confirm that the experiences other people are talking about are the same as theirs. That starts to look to me like something that would meet that test, you know, or certainly that should get far enough through the process that Redress Scotland could make an analysis of the evidence. But because of the individual nature of the applications going forward, we're not looking at that collective picture, and that to me isn't consistent with what with what your predecessor said when he recognised that this was a grey area, that these issues were very difficult and that they would have to be looked at in detail. But if they can't even be looked at in detail, how do you work out whether or not it meets the balance of probabilities test?
An excellent summing up, I think, by that gentleman. Just to finish the segment, Diane, that meeting didn't reach a positive conclusion for the Fonethi women. Where do you see the whole thing going now?
It will be reviewed again in the Petitions Committee in, I guess, about 3 weeks from now. I believe it's the 17th of April. The committee will consider the evidence in private, and at that next meeting, we'll hopefully find out where it could go. It could go to full parliamentary debate. I have a feeling I wasn't so positive at all leaving the meeting, because mostly all I could hear was Shona Robinson's side, and it was very stressful for me and for the survivors to hear it in the room. But after watching this video several times, I'm hoping that if we can encourage the other MSPs to continue to consider the evidence that I've submitted, which I believe is much more detailed and much more accurate than the official independent so-called report that was submitted and paid for by the Scottish government, that we can make some positive changes. And really, the petition is only for the women to be able to apply for the scheme of redress, not to get it, but the fact that they're being told by Shona Robinson that they're not even allowed to apply, making these assumptions that are incorrect about what records are needed just for an application, is completely unacceptable, in my opinion. So please, fingers crossed for all of the women as we go forward into this next month. Thank you.
Okay, Diane, thank you very much for that report. You will be staying with us for UK Column Extra, and we'll discuss the Fenethi case in more detail, and details of previous UK Column articles will go up in today's show notes. Alex, let's bring you back with us, and the subject is transgender children in France.
I heartily recommend people read very carefully Professor Mercadi's piece, which is up on in Pride of Place on the ukcolumn.org website at the moment, long detailed and full of primary sources, will be hard to rebut. So in France, they were about to copy the National Health Service of Britain, which last month decided that you couldn't prescribe puberty blockers to the underage. And then this happened, as carried by the Daily Telegraph, sex reassignment in minors may be medical history's greatest ethical scandal, French report says. And this is a report by a bloc of 18 senators from the party which leads the billing in the upper house of the French parliament, the Republicans. They're not the governing party, but they are the most important party in the Senate, LR for short. And they have now, as also covered now by French Génétique, described in great detail. People can follow the show notes to this and use an auto-translate to find out more detail. They have really pleaded for the process of transgendering a minor to be unlawful. Here are the two reports in question for those who read French and or can use auto translate. This will be in the subtitle in the show notes as well. So it's something like a large minority report in the French Senate, trans identification of minors, dated March 2024, and also the conclusions and recommendations of that document. From the recommendations, we find this. I won't read them all, but they're talking about interdire a lot, so prohibiting. They want prohibiting puberty blockers being prescribed. Britain, Sweden, other countries have gone down this route to the shock of the trans movement recently. Ensuring that the state is neutral in the matter. Basically, it's a bit shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted, but they're recognizing, as in other Western countries, that activists have infiltrated the system. Stopping the administration and prescription of hormones to all minor citizens. These things, of course, you'd expect to be required de rigueur in any serious Western country, but not anymore. The second part of their recommendations is in the domain of administration and education. And here they're demanding that national education authorities and civil servants respect the actual sex of children, not have these games that are played across the West now, where the child comes to school, swaps clothing and swaps name, and it's all secret. So it's something that could be watched in times to come, because this could potentially get through the French Senate.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Now, where does that take us? I think this brings us into the World Health Organization, and let's welcome Mark Anderson on screen.
Good day, everyone. The World Health Organization this past Thursday, the 21st of March, held a press conference, and I covered it in real time virtually. So that's an actual original photo of our friend Tedros, the director general there. And they were kindly enough to provide a transcript via email. So moving on from there, I can kind of outline and summarize this. They had different sections on the pandemic treaty, a little bit on the international health regulations, and a bit on Gaza and Haiti and WHO responses to those crises. Anyway, on the pandemic part, Tedros had this to say: whose member states are meeting to negotiate an historic, legally binding agreement to protect future generations from the impact of pandemics. Moving on from there, he also added, there's much agreement, he claimed, between the member states on the objectives of the agreement. Now they need to agree on how to achieve those objectives. But what I picked up on, guys, and our lady guest, was that things aren't quite as stable, and they're not moving along quite as well as he'd like people to believe. You could sense that in the way they answered questions, and they avoided my raised hand through the virtual system. I've tried to ask questions at several of their press conferences, and I still haven't been called on yet. I won't take it personally. Anyway, Tedros also said this. There's one more quote from him. Areas of disagreement remain, but there is still enough time for countries to find common ground and finalize a strong agreement in time for the World Health Assembly in 9 weeks. It's doable. However, if we keep going, we detect a little bit more of a tentative attitude about how things are going. Robin Millard of AFP, not to be confused with the AFP I've worked for, did get a question in. It was a lot like the question I wanted to ask, and the question was as follows. On the pandemic accord negotiations, the letter from dozens of former world leaders, get that, suggests that there is a concern that this treaty might not get done. What are the key sticking points that remain? I wanted to ask that too. What needs to happen to get this over the line, and who needs to budge? Thank you. And from there, we get the answer from Dr. Jouad Major, head of the Secretariat, to both the intergovernmental negotiating body that's working on the treaty and the IHR, which is the International Health Regulations. He said, and these are very general things, this was his reply to the reporter, prevention is extremely important for pandemic preparedness and response. No kidding. Negotiators agreed on the importance of research and development, which is, again, very generic and very milquetoast. His third answer, or third part of his answer, they agreed, the negotiators on the treaty, on the importance of having a global supply chain to provide all the signatory countries with what they need for pandemic response, which, again, seems like no achievement at all. That's a very easy thing to agree on. And the fourth part of his answer to the reporter, we're now discussing how to implement these things, although some issues are tougher to resolve than others. So they kept giving very general kind of brush off answers. And this reporter here was not the only one that asked that kind of question. I wanted to do it. Robin Millard did. And there was another reporter, and we kept getting these very general, almost brush off again, kind of replies. So things don't seem to be going quite as smoothly as the who would like, for them to approve the treaty as they had planned at the 77th World Health Assembly in Geneva. And they're trying to achieve that treaty May 24th. Anyway, to give the WHO a little credit where credit's due, they did give a brief report on Gaza, a bit on Haiti. They said only half of Haiti's health facilities are functioning, hospitals and whatnot. But on Gaza, they did make some important revelations. WHO and our partners have been conducting high-risk missions to deliver medicines, fuel, and food for health workers and their patients. And the Israeli authorities keep getting in the way. The WHO said they're particularly concerned about military operations inside and around Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Accessing Al-Shifa is now impossible, and there are reports of health workers being arrested and detained by Israeli forces. Once again, the WHO said, we ask Israel to be more open about crossings, that is, roadways and transportation, and accelerate the entry and delivery of water, food, medicine, and medical supplies. And they've been trying to set up nutrition centers for children in hospitals. So the WHO did provide some helpful information on that all-important issue. Moving on from there, I believe that might wrap it up for today. But there is one other breaking item. I want to make sure I get this in. And I just got this from James Roguski, the noted WHO watchdog. His blog, of course, is jamesroguski.substack.com. I've got my desktop on. It creates a little more light. But anyway, on this past Friday, the House of Representatives in the U.S., according to the Sovereignty Coalition, voted on a $1.2 trillion bill that included full funding for the WHO and allegedly no requirement that the Senate consider the two treaties expected to be finalized and approved 64 days from now. By two treaties, I suspect that means the IHR as well as the actual treaty. But anyway, the Sovereignty Coalition is saying all hands on deck, and there's a Zoom meeting tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. I'm going to go ahead and take part on that, in that, and report on that next week, guys. And those that want to take part in the UK, it would be 1 in the morning if you wanted to be on the live Zoom call. But for the show notes, I'll go ahead and send in the link, if that would be okay, if anyone anywhere in the world wants to dial in on this Zoom meeting tonight about what's going on with U.S. funding of the WHO and the threats to sovereignty that the WHO's pandemic treaty poses. So that's a very important breaking item here from James Rogoski. And that's about it, guys, for now.
Okay, Mark, thank you very much for that update. Well, we will say to all those watching UK Column News today, if you like what we do, please join us, support us, take out a membership, make a donation. We can only do what we do with your financial support. You can also, of course, help us by making a purchase through the shop. There's still a lot of good items there. And in particular, the MHRA T-shirts are still going very strongly. And stickers are very popular. But of course, we encourage you to use those stickers responsibly. And the most important thing for us to say is that the overwhelming bulk of material from UK Column we put out for people to share in order to get facts and truth and information circulating. So if you can help share and circulate information, that's great. Please do acknowledge us. Now, we are having a little bit of a break this Easter, so there will not be a UK Column News on Friday the 29th of March or Monday the 1st of April. But as I've just said, thank you all so much for your support. And we will look forward to seeing you all after the Easter break. And tomorrow should be, of course, the 26th of March. We've got an interview going out with Morgan Lorette. So encourage people to tune in at 1 o'clock in order to listen into that. Now, what can we say about UK and many other so-called sovereign states in the world? It's very hard to imagine that the UK government is running the country, or indeed the national governments and many other European countries, because we have so many think tanks operating in the background. And I just want to say thank you to one of UK Column's very, very long-term supporters, viewers and researchers, Kate, who sent me in some information over the weekend, flagging up the Aspen Institute, busy at work in Ukraine. And the point being made was, for most people, this is a totally unaccountable think tank, which is up to, I was going to say, no good. Well, of course, we can't say that because we have no idea really what they're doing, but they are certainly not accountable to the voting public. So where do they link in? Well, the link of the Aspen Institute led us through to a number of things, but the Carlile Foundation came up fairly quickly. This forms global partnerships with the Commonwealth, UNESCO, the Prince's Trust and the Aspen Institute that we've just mentioned. And if we put up some detail here, it says that the Carlile Foundation and the Prince's Trust, through the Mosaic Initiative, have launched an exciting new social integration and youth leadership project, Youth. And the subject of youth and using youth is a very common thing for these think tanks. It says the partnership begins with a year-long pilot program, which will enable young people and young professionals to co-design and co-deliver training and Prince's Trust program activity. Goes on to talk more about the Mosaic Initiative, and it says it's serving to help young people and young professionals to lead dialogue and discussion around global citizenship. So now we see the meat of the thing. This is bringing in the idea of global governance and global citizenship. But if we have a little bit, look in a little bit more depth at the Carlile Foundation, we've got this, Designing for Diversity, Cities and Communities. And this is the main gentleman concerned. Now, if we pop the next one on screen, thank you. So we've got Professor Nazir Carlile is a world-renowned scholar, collector and philanthropist. His mission is to use the power of art and education to foster peace and unity worldwide. This is all very well, but I personally don't really understand his values or what he's trying to do. But I do know he's a very influential and powerful individual. And here we see him with the Right Honourable Patricia Scotland, who's the Secretary General of the Commonwealth. We can bring that up on screen there. Thank you. And they are working together for a festival. This is what's being promoted with this image, Peace Building Through Faith, roundtable discussions aimed at identifying key focus areas and brainstorming solutions to today's most urgent challenges. So let's have a look at a little piece of video to reinforce the good works of these individuals.
And young people are the cornerstone of everything we intend to do.
Virtually encapsulate 50 years of my vision. I always said to myself that every human being is born as a human being first. Everything else that's given to you, color, religion, race, you didn't choose, you were given. So that unity brings all of us together as a human being. So it was my dream one day to look at all the differences, build on the differences with the proper answers and bring them together.
So the point that I'm making is that this gentleman's dream is the power that's coming into the Commonwealth to interface with all of the children within the Commonwealth worldwide, and its proper solutions. But what are those solutions, and does the voting public know? And of course, we don't. So it's the power of these organisations behind the scenes. We don't really know what they're up to, but we just get glimpses. Let's choose another one, the Franco-British Council. We've mentioned them before because they were working with the British government in order to introduce applied political psychology. And that was a very big programme. But again, we see that they're after local leaders, and they're particularly targeting young people and bringing them through a training process, which is going to align them with both French and British policy. But if we get into the Franco-British Council, I was alerted to the fact that at the end of last year, towards the end of last year, they had another defence conference, and decisions were being made here, and discussions were taking place, which the British public was simply not privy to, not least because they were holding the meetings under the Chatham House rules. Here's some of the rules on screen. But of course, many glasses of wine or champagne being drunk to help the deliberations. And we can also see the support of major companies. We've got the Ministry of Defence there, but we've got MBDA Missile Systems and Airbus, as well as the French military. And if we move on one, of course, we've got our very own Grant Shapps, who was there. But remember that the discussions, apart from the main headlines, were being held under Chatham House rules and not privy for the British public. Here's Lord Peter Ricketts, who's actually the chair of the organisation. And if we have a look at him, we can see that he was the UK's first national security advisor 2010-2012. We're not too sure exactly what he was doing in these meetings, but this is the whole point, who is making policy. And we'll just leave you with the last comment on the Chatham House rules, because it says here that local leaders are expected to abide by it, and strict implementation of the rule is crucial to its effectiveness. And lastly, you should be respectful to guests and speakers and mindful of the fact that they've agreed to give their time. So at that point, I think we've just about covered it, but essentially we're saying, what is it that's enabling these organisations to dictate policy, both to the UK's national government, but also to the French? And when Macron suggested French troops on the ground in Ukraine, was that as a result of a pre-agreement with the British through the Franco-British Council? Alex, I've thrown a lot of questions into that little segment, but I think there's a lot of things we need to ask.
Well, Brian, it's interesting you mention that, because both the Habeck speech, the German vice chancellor, and the Macron announcement prompted our very keen regular viewer, Terry Boardman, the noted author and speaker, to message me the other day and say this very much puts me in mind of Earl Grey's speech of the 3rd of August 1914, the most deceptive speech perhaps ever delivered to Parliament, saying Britain doesn't want a world war, and then as it were, behind his hat, but we've already told the French that our navy's in play for the coming world war. And of course, we were already 8 years into negotiations with Belgium then, while Belgium was pretending to Germany still to be a neutral country. So lots of discussion there. More in extra time if we can fit it in about the deep state, because the New York Times has come out with a puff piece commissioned from freelancers saying, isn't the deep state wonderful, nothing to worry about. Those who were listening to Mark Anderson regarding this evening's Zoom call, this is one of the few weeks of the year where, due to misalignment of daylight savings time, it will only be midnight start, not a 1 a.m. start for those following from Britain. So perhaps a few more will be able to join because of that. So with two Americans as guests today, one of whom is half Canadian, this may interest. The Toronto Globe and Mail, one of the most important papers in the whole English-speaking world, has got one of its heavy hitters, Lawrence Martin, writing an opinion piece telling us that excessive free speech, which, of course, south of the border from the Canadian perspective is a thing because of the First Amendment, that excessive free speech is a breeding ground for more Trumps. Mr. Martin says, would the rise of the hard right and Mr. Trump have been possible if the internet had been given guardrails? Not a chance. The internet undermined the established newspaper business model, we hear him shriek, greatly reducing the number of papers and coverage and creating a void. Oh dear, so it's actually something to do with the legacy media. To be fair to Mr. Martin, he's not an extremist in legacy media terms. He does say in this very opinion piece that Bill C-63, which is life imprisonment for hate speech, may be pushing it a bit too far. But if you look at his biography, you will see that he's been based in Washington for years for Canada's leading newspaper title, and that he is a recipient of many awards, including McMaster University's Lifetime Leadership Achievement Award. So he's not a minor figure there. We see what's coming. True North, a fairly middle-of-the-road Canadian outlet, is reporting that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is going to spend $8.4 million Canadian dollars on research in the South, the global South, the third world we used to call it, to understand, quote, how climate change interacts with democratic decline. So the poor dark-skinned people of the world do not get to choose their leaders freely and fairly because of climate change, it would seem. Finally, in this mini Canadian segment, the National Post is reporting that a secret report by the Mounties, the RCMP, Canada's federal police, this was a 5-year whole of government review of threat horizon for Canada, says that Canadians may revolt once they realize how broke they are, that under 35s will never be able to buy a place to live in Canada because the house prices there are even worse than the US and Europe. It's secret, but it's a heavily redacted version was eked out through freedom of information. And ironically, it says, and there'll be more about this kind of irony from Germany shortly, the report's particularly heavily redacted sections included one carrying subtitle, Erosion of Trust. Well, think of what we were just reading in the opinion piece from the Globe and Mail. It's the pleb's fault, but apparently it's also the government's fault. Paranoid populism on the rise.
Alex, thank you very much for that. It gets crazier, doesn't it? Climate change affects democracy. Well, the other group that the global governance team is worried about are vaccine hesitant people. And Mark, welcome back. Tell us what's happening and how AI is going to be used to predict vaccine hesitancy.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, this is from the defender of the Children's Health Defense. Of course, that's Robert Francis Kennedy Jr. And AI is, of course, worming its way into everything. I'll mention the border in a minute, the southern border. But here we have from the defender, the whole thing smacks of a brave new world. New AI tool predicts vaccine hesitancy, and we'll go from there. As this article notes, a team of researchers, and it's connected to the University of Cincinnati in Ohio, has developed a powerful new tool in artificial intelligence that can predict if someone is or isn't likely to get a COVID-19 vaccine or something like it. According to the University of Cincinnati, the new AI tool, quote, uses a small set of data from demographics and personal judgments, such as aversion to risk or loss, end quote, to identify, quote, reward and aversion judgment patterns, those kind of patterns in humans that may help explain one's willingness or unwillingness to get vaccinated. The researchers presented their findings in a study published recently in the Journal of Medical Internet Research, Public Health and Surveillance. The study's findings could have broad applications for predicting mental health and result in more effective public health campaigns, the university said. Now, someone from the Defender had a reply to that. This is Brian Hooker, PhD. He's the Children's Health Defense Senior Director of Science and Research. He said the following: the whole implication here is that nonconformity to the government propaganda machine's standard of care makes someone makes one some type of mental case or extreme outlier. And Mr. Hooker also had this to say. In addition, he said, going back, the whole thing smacks of a Brave New World where a potentially non-compliant individuals, where such individuals are targeted with messaging based on fear and irrationality. So this is a relatively brief report for today, but it's providing some insight on where AI is going. Of course, it's going way too many places, way too fast. As we've talked about recently in the Montana case, the fraud regarding Google's AI products, Gemini, Montana's already raising the specter of suing Google because the Gemini product had the wrong input, therefore it would give the wrong answers when asked. So AI is only as good as the data put in terms of the data coming out. And then this other headline I'll just briefly mention. I need not go into detail. This requires more research. But the Department of Homeland Security, that wonderful post 9/11 agency in the U.S. government, has announced the following, and this is very recent. Department of Homeland Security unveils AI roadmap and announces pilot projects to maximize the benefits of technology and advance the Homeland Security mission. And we'll get into more details on that in another time, guys. But it just shows how AI is being used in a really kind of a very unregulated and careless manner. And it's threatening, of course, medical choice, which is also an issue with the WHO treaty that I talked about today, and how that might affect sovereignty and individual medical choice. So back to you, Brian.
Okay. Well, it gets ever more bizarre. Thank you very much, Mark. Alex, where do we go with you?
Well, I suspect that Professor McCaddy will have something to say about this in extra time, the segment we've just heard, being an information specialist. But we go to Germany, where another COVID leak has hit the big time. Professor Stefan Homburg, a government advisor and a noted financial academic from Hanover, who has endured a lot of ire and flack through the COVID times from his government, is one of the people who's tweeted this in English, so giving it a cover story for us, that the RKI files are out. That's the Robert Koch Institute, Germany's leading public health body, equivalent to, in some cases, the CDC and in its role in Germany. Or it sounds like a charity, but it's the RKI really is at the heart of the German government in public health. And he brings out the two highlights of this massive data leak, although there's redactions in it, which is one is that high health risk was not derived from data, but it was a political decision. And by the way, a federal decision in what is supposed to be a competence for the individual states in Germany. And secondly, herd immunity was a mere narrative. It was dropped, as the documents show, once the jab came along in the start of 2021. Multipolar, again, used FOI legislation and a subsequent lawsuit, a lesson for us in there. If you don't get everything you want through FOI, then sue for more. And he says that they're very important for English-speaking countries too. In particular, this slide, which he shared from the data dump, the bottom of it shows that this is from the 16th of March 2020, when the whole world, including Germany, was saying COVID was not a great shake in health terms for humans. They're saying here that the risk evaluation, which in other words, cranking it up to high health risk to humans, will be published as soon as censored gives the signal. And that's probably the then health minister, Jens Spahn, the predecessor of Mr. Lauterbach, the even more awful one, in my opinion. This is very ironic, given what I was saying earlier. The section on communication, completely blank. We only know that the BZGA, which is the Federal Health Information Agency, was going to do a lot of communication. Where's the British connection? Well, here it is. Eugypius comes up to our top again, as he often does. This will all be in the show notes. He says that on this very day, the 16th of March, when you saw that Mr. Blank was going to say it's suddenly a high health risk to humans, guys, that very day, Neil Ferguson and his Imperial College team in Britain had just posted their notorious paper calling for rolling lockdowns. So it's not suggesting that Britain steered Germany here, but somebody steered them both, I would suggest. A viewer's email just to round off on Germany, asking in very erudite terms whether we're aware, and yes, I am, that Germany doesn't even have a constitution. I won't read the whole text. But yes, what they do have is a basic law, Grundgesetz and the Allies, we in Britain, Britain, France and the USA are responsible for that. We broke our promise, and Germany has this very terroristic organization that goes around battering doors down now in the name of constitution protection. They don't even have a constitution.
Okay, Alex, thank you very much. Constitutional issues. Mark, that brings you straight back in, I think, with the missing constitutional right.
Yes, last week I also covered another event in real time, virtually online, and I reported about it in advance last week, you might recall. The missing constitutional right at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University in its Washington, D.C. branch, Richard L. Hassan spoke. He was moderated by Wilfred Codrington III. And it was an interesting, if not kind of puzzling, presentation. It need only be a brief report today. Here's a picture of the two presenters, mainly Mr. Hassan on the right. He's a political science professor at UCLA, which is in California. We'll move on from there. He had this to say, and he's talking about the U.S. system, of course. We have this highly decentralized election system. I'm advocating for a movement to assure voting rights. Democracy isn't going to protect itself. Anyway, he has a book out. He wants to enshrine voting rights in the national constitution of the United States. There are a number of problems with that. I believe we have another quote from him, if I'm not mistaken.
Not sure we do, actually.
Perhaps not. Yeah. Anyway, I'll just add this. He went into this whole spiel about how we need to have voting rights enshrined in the Constitution, and he's kind of impatient with the decentralized manner of the U.S. election system. But he overlooked the fact, very important things. He believed, for instance, the 17th Amendment to the Constitution was a good thing. What that did was provide, in the year 1913, that's the change, when the change was made. The 17th Amendment was adopted, and it provided for the direct election of U.S. senators. But what Mr. Hassan failed to talk about was that the U.S. Constitution was set up so the individual states would appoint U.S. senators, so state rights and state input would have higher standing in the constitutional order. The popular election of U.S. senators has actually been largely a very bad thing. It's made senators lifelong in their seats. Many of the senior senators have been there forever, Charles Schumer of New York and whatnot. It becomes a virtual Politburo in the upper chamber in Washington. And Senate races, which are statewide for U.S. Senate, have become extremely expensive, a lot of influence peddling. And by and large, states' rights were then suppressed within the constitutional order. So the 17th Amendment, which Mr. Hassan totally ignored, has been largely a boondoggle and not a good thing. He also talked as if the Constitution is full of these huge problems, Brian, and that rights for voting are not really recognized. But then he went ahead and mentioned that the 15th Amendment to the Constitution in the year 1870, that gave African-American men the right to vote. In 1920, the 19th Amendment gave women the right to vote. So that's two amendments. And another amendment to the Constitution, the 26th Amendment in 1971, lowered the age of voting from 21 to 18. So actually, it kind of contradicted his own argument. As he named off all these amendments that did expand voting rights, he kept maintaining the argument that voting rights still are not properly represented in the U.S. Constitution. But anyway, to sum it up, he's pushing for this difficult thing, a constitutional amendment, which requires two-thirds of each House of Congress to approve it and three-fourths of the states. So it's a very high bar to get any constitutional amendment passed. And I talked to Garland Favorito. We're familiar with him. I did an interview with him. It's still posted on the UK Column website. He's from the Georgia group, Voters Organized for Trusted Election Results in Georgia. And I asked him his opinion, and he believes that this is just a serpentine way of trying to nationalize or federalize elections in the United States. In other words, centralize the process more. And that would, of course, get rid of the current system which the founders put in place, and that's to have the states independently elect the federal government. So this is what's being seen behind the scenes, according to Mr. Favorito of that Voter GA group. There'll be more down the road. This one has some shelf life, but I followed through and found this guy's arguments to be rather weak. So back to you, Brian.
Okay. Thank you very much for that, Mark. Well, let's just end quickly, if we may, Alex, on the subject of wind farms in France.
Yes, Stop These Things is the blog that reports this best in English. A top French court strikes down unlawful wind farm planning rules. It's actually even retroactive. This is a really powerful finding. I will not read all that, but look in the middle there, you'll find an accurate and very welcome description of the French Council of State. It's something that really breaks the separation of powers, but sometimes it has its uses. It legally advises the executive, and it's the Supreme Court for administrative justice, which means people complaining about their government's actions towards them. And you'll see at the top there that there's two Australian rulings that this blog covers as well, finding the same reason why wind farms are a bad thing and unlawful and unjust, namely that the measurement of noise, pollution, annoyance and distress to people and animals is not properly done. The Council of State here, this is described in Tichy's Einblick as well. You'll find it in the show notes and a German piece. Basically struck out all of the noise pollution measurement protocols which the French state has put into place, basically in the name of a minister, and has said that this has not been tested properly. There's no comeback on it. There's no transparency. And being France, they've decided to go the whole hog and say that if you build any wind farms from now on, they must be completely assessed for environment. And existing ones now are found to have been based on illegal ministerial decrees because there was no proportionality or transparency. So normally, in normal circumstances, they will be banned from operating existing wind farms in a European Union member state. Quite something. There we are. There's the German Tichy's Einblick giving more detail, which I won't read now. But it is a violation of the law. That's the key thing that the Council of State found. It's not just saying we wish that things were done better. It's actually telling the government they've done wrong. And there's the judgment itself, which is, of course, is in French, will be linked in the show notes, telling people in government that you cannot get away with any more wind farms on the basis of these unassessed decrees that the noise annoyance is within tolerable limits.
Alex, thank you very much for that. Fascinating report, because many, many years ago when the wind farms were starting to go up in Cornwall, UK Column was contacted by a number of people talking about the noise problem. And I found it interesting that when I read the environmental impact reports, such as there were at that stage, they were extremely weak on noise. And my own experience in noise in the Royal Navy, underwater noise, but many of the tributes are exactly the same, told me that a lot more work was needed in order to be able to be sure that there weren't noise problems associated, particularly low-frequency noise associated with the actual turbine blades rotating themselves as opposed to the gearbox noise. But maybe more on that another time. Alex, end us very quickly. You've got a couple of memes which we thought were worth showing the audience today.
Apologies that I don't know the source of this US cartoon, but you can see America on fire with crumbling infrastructure, total alcohol and drug dependence. And there is wizened old senile Uncle Joe telling America's kids that democracy is in danger, and he's holding up a hand puppet of Trump as the devil incarnate. Well, apparently there's nothing to see wrong with the current administration. We have a German meme here. Somebody is being SWAT raided for some free speech in Germany, and they're being yelled at the door to open up, it's democracy calling. And finally, it's not even a comedy piece, but it's certainly got something sweet about it. Glasgow City Council, much featured in today's news, is having a mutiny against its own low emission zone because it being Glasgow, people do as they please. They don't shy away from authority figures. So many of the council's own workers, which is a huge number of people in Glasgow, are saying, I am not paying these penalties. So the council may be hoist by its own petard there.
What a world. Clown world. I think many people are starting to call it, but it's clown world with some very dark attributes in the background. I'm going to thank you all, Alex and Mark, and also Professor Rasmussen Pagadi. Thank you very much for joining us for the news. As I said, we will be talking about Fanethi in extra time. So if you're a member of UK Column, join us then. Thank you to all the viewers and listeners who've come in today, wherever you are in the world. Bye-bye.